Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Thursday, October 12, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss the new book, The Unexpected Scalia, A Conservative Justice's Liberal Opinions. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome three guests to Teleforum today. This is going to be a moderated discussion. I'll introduce the moderator last, but I want to thank in advance all of our participants. We have the author of The Unexpected Scalia, David M. Dorson. He's of counsel at Sedgwick. We also have, commenting on the book, Michael D. Ramsey, professor. He's the Hugh and Hazel Darling Foundation Professor of Law and the Director of the International and Comparative Law Programs at the University of San Diego School of Law. Importantly, he's also a former clerk of Justice Scalia. And our moderator today is Dean Alan B. Morrison, Lerner Family Associate Dean for Public Interest and Public Service Law, and a professorial lecturer in law at the George Washington University Law School right here in Washington, D.C. We're going to proceed sort of an interview format with Dean Morrison conducting the interview, asking questions of our two other guests. We do hope to have time for questions from the audience, so be thinking of those. But with that, Dean Morrison, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. So, David, let's begin by asking or having you tell everybody, what is your relation to Justice Scalia and how you came to write this book?
Well, I met Justice Scalia in the early fall of 1958 when we overlapped 1 year at the Harvard Law School and 1 year on the Harvard Law Review. I was 1 year ahead of him. We struck up an acquaintanceship and it developed over the years so that by the early part of this century, after I recovered from Bush v. Gore, my wife and I invited him and his wife Maureen over for dinner, and we hit it off and continued with the regular dinners and visits to various places, ranging from opera to horse racing. The book came about because we talked a lot about the law, and it just sort of grew out of discussions, and particularly when I started looking into the number of liberal opinions, because we tended to disagree on most issues. I'm a liberal Democrat atheist, let's say, and he is certainly none of the above.
So the thesis of the book is that many of Justice Scalia's opinion were liberal. Tell us your definition of liberal.
Well, I struggled with that and ultimately decided that I could not come up with a comprehensive definition. So I listed at the beginning of the book those kinds of issues that would render somebody a liberal, ranging from government participation and involvement, pro-defendant, pro-choice, a whole host of things. And there were one or two that were a little sticky, such as whether favoring a white-collar criminal defendant was liberal or conservative. I ultimately chose to say that it was liberal, even though many liberals have a rather negative record or pro-prosecution record of white-collar criminals.
I noticed one of the nice observations in the book on page 53, and this is the book, The Unexpected Scalia, that you could not possibly write the converse of this book about the opinions of Justices Brennan or Marshall, that they would not have written very many conservative opinions. How about Justice Breyer? Do you think you might be able to write such a book about him?
Well, I might write a book about him, but I'm not sure there'll be very many conservative opinions. He tended to be more receptive to government regulation and a few other things that can sometimes sort of slip over to being conservative. He was occasionally conservative on such things as obscenity, for children especially, and it's a fascinating subject. And I might get to it one day, but I certainly don't feel myself an expert at the moment.
Mike Ramsey, are we all on the same page? Do you think this is a reasonable definition of liberal, at least for these purposes?
Yeah, I agree that it's not possible to define liberal specifically or technically, and you have to just go with some general categories, and I think David's done a good job with that. There might be a few that I would quibble with here and there, but I think the overall project makes a lot of sense. You think about, well, what are the outcomes that your sort of standard Republican's going to agree with and on the merits, and what are the outcomes that your sort of standard Democrat's going to agree with on the merits, and you can see those categories shaping up, and then the question is, to what extent does Scalia map onto that as a standard Republican, and then what you find out is that he doesn't. At least he doesn't all the time, and that's what the book's about. And I think it makes a great project, and I completely agree with the conclusions on that.
And do we all agree that, Mike, especially, that there have to be a large number of these cases? David's book suggests there's something like 135 of them out of perhaps 800 and something opinions that Justice Scalia wrote, and that at most of these cases that he points to are cases in which they're divided votes, or at least not necessarily with dissents, but at least with radically different concurring opinions, and that this is news only if there are significant numbers of those. Is that a statement you could agree with?
Yes, I agree with that, and I think the book demonstrates it, and I think the book's very important for that reason, because I think a lot of people, and even people who are pretty sophisticated about the Supreme Court, have this sort of conventional political science-y kind of view that you can line the justices up on an ideological spectrum, and then you can identify sort of who the median justice is, and sort of how the median justice's vote plays in disputed cases ends up being what the case turns on, and disappointingly, that there's a lot of truth to that, and you can think about a lot of cases where that really describes pretty well what's going on. But I think that what this book shows, and you do, I think, have enough opinions that David has identified, enough opinions where you can say, not just once or twice, but in a material number of opinions, not a majority of opinions, but in a material number of his opinions, Justice Scalia didn't fit that conventional model, that he ended up aligning with more liberal-oriented justices and coming to more liberal-oriented conclusions. And it wasn't just, we can all name one or two cases, you know, the flag burning case where he voted to in favor of the flag burners or a few criminal law cases, but actually you find that there's quite a range across quite a number of different areas of the Constitution. That's what this book is really valuable in demonstrating, I think, is that it's not that it was just one or two cases, but it was pretty consistently across his career and across quite a number of areas of the Constitution where he would at times defy this sort of simplistic model of justices voting in political alignment.
David, this is more than just numbers or happenstance. You have a theory as to how this happens, and I think it's tied to the justices' theory of interpretation. Is that a fair way? Is that where you would put it too?
Yeah, absolutely. Justice Scalia was a self-proclaimed originalist textualist. Which is, in the former case of originalists, it's much, much more complicated than that. For example, he was not an originalist in basic free speech cases and a few other areas, and he's widely considered more of an originalist than he is. Nevertheless, he followed originalism in many situations, and with very few exceptions, in my opinion, he followed them even when his thinking, his originalist research and approach, took him to liberal results. And that's essentially what he did. He just said, well, how would this have been decided in 1792 or 1788 or whatever, and try to come up with that decision. The other half of the equation, or the other half of one side of the equation, is textualism, where he read words very carefully, very literally, very semantically, and took those readings and rendered a decision in accordance with his readings, even when they led him to liberal results. I'm not saying, and I hope we come to this later, that he was always a good historian or a good textualist, although he was a good textualist, but that's how he ended up with quite a few liberal opinions.
So on the textualism side, Is that applicable both to the Constitution and to statutes, or more to the latter than the former?
Actually, again, there's very little originalism in statutes, so it is, in a sense, a more important feature of the statutory interpretation, but it frequently comes up in constitutional interpretation, and if I'll mention one if you want to stick with it or come back to it later. The Confrontation Clause is, interestingly enough, much more of, in my opinion, a textualist analysis than a originalist analysis.
So let's go back to the originalism. As I understand it, Justice Scalia did not purport to be deciding what the framers actually intended in a subjective way, but what the reader at the time would have understood. Is that correct? And did he apply any adjectives as to what kind of a reader we're talking about?
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. There was a school of Bork and Robert Bork and some others that looked to the framers' intent, and that got rather bogged down, whether it was the framers, the ratifiers, or just who. And Justice Scalia came up with the idea that what is important is not what people thought subjectively, which he rejected, but what people would have thought a particular provision meant at the time.
And what kind of people are we talking about here? Are we talking about the people who wrote it, the people who were educated, the people who were in the know, the reasonable person, or the average person in the streets?
That's one of my objections to his originalism. I think it's really impossible to say. Today you look at a provision of the that's being debated in the Supreme, argued in the Supreme Court, and it splits 5-3-1 or something, and the premise of Justice Scalia's originalism was that there would be some sort of consensus or even unanimity, and that did not exist. I think to the extent that there is a thread, it is a well-informed citizen in that period. But again, that doesn't make sense, because what people thought in the South was different from what people thought in the North. What people thought in the cities was different from what people thought in the farms. What people thought who were religious was different from what people thought who were not religious, and on and on. So I think that concept is essentially unworkable. And I think most people would come to that conclusion if they really thought about what it would mean today when you have 9 members of the Supreme Court who have very similar backgrounds, having such disparate views of constitutional history. What we're talking about with Justice Scalia's sort of reasonable person is a much broader and much diverse group of people that really had no single concept of what was happening and what the history was.
Mike, do you think that's a fair understanding of the justice's originalism views?
I mostly agree with that, and I realize that my role in this call as a commentator is to some extent to be disagreeable, so I'm trying to find some place to be disagreeable here, but
Don't be disagreeable, please.
I think I may find some place, but just to start off, I think that the basic proposition here is correct, that what the justice was looking for was not some sort of speculation about the subjective intent or what the framers were trying to accomplish or what they expected to happen or so forth, but it was, and indeed he was one of the first people who began the movement in this direction in originalism theory, to focusing on the original meaning of the text as it would be understood by a reasonable reader of the time, and not trying to sort of psychoanalyze James Madison bring him back to life and ask him what he thought or would have thought or anything like that, but instead just try to understand what does this set of words mean in the context in which it was written, and I do think that's what he was trying to accomplish. Now I think that there's something of an ambiguity there that I'm not sure that Justice Scalia ever fully resolved in his own mind, and which continues to be debated in originalism theory, which is what kind of a reader are we talking about? How much do we expect this reader to know? Are they just sort of a reasonable person in the street, or are they somebody who is educated in the law, educated in the history, in the context, and so can apply quite a bit of contextual analysis to finding out what a word means? And I think Scalia, most of the time when he was writing opinions, he was engaging in some fairly sophisticated legal analysis. So I think you see him assuming a pretty sophisticated reader as his hypothetical reader. At the same time, he talked about the need of having the Constitution be interpreted in a way that would have been open to or understandable to reasonable ordinary readers, who to some extent the ratifiers were. So I think there is a little bit of tension in that. And like I said, that's a tension in a lot of originalism theory and something that's still sort of being worked out. But so to make sure that I do get some point of disagreement in here, and I think this will come out later in the call as well, is that that I think that my view is that the Originalism Project, although it has some things that still need to be worked out in it, and I don't suggest that Justice Scalia had all the answers, but I think that it is a more manageable project than David suggests in his book, and quite a bit of his book, in addition to being to talking about Justice Scalia's liberal opinions, is really a critique of originalism. And there are some things he says there that I agree with, but a number that I don't. And one that I don't agree with is that that it's impossible to figure out what sort of a reasonable person would have thought. I think that we're not trying to establish that there was unanimity, and I don't think Justice Scalia ever suggested that he was looking for unanimity as to what a provision meant. But the question is what's the best reading? What's the most plausible reading? What's the reading that would have appealed to the most reasonable or the majority of reasonable readers? It's a hypothetical exercise because we can't go back and ask everybody. It's not clear that you would even want to go back and ask everybody, because that would just be confusing, and you'd be talking to a lot of people who were not educated about the origins of the language. But what you can do is you can look at what the language says, what the consensus meanings of words were, what the origins were, what the context was, and you can come to what's really not certainty, but it's the most plausible understanding given the context of the time. And that's what he was trying to accomplish. I think he was modest about that. I don't think he supposed that everything was 100% clear, or that every single person at the time would have agreed with it. But that's what we're trying to do, is just trying to understand, as you would understand any language that's written in a time other than your own, you just try to get the best feel for it you can.
David, we're going to come back to that in a discussion. I'd like to talk to our audience and illustrate a couple of cases in the criminal law area to see how it plays out. And the first one I think we ought to talk about is United States against Jones. The government had attached a GPS to the defendant's car, and the question was, is this an illegal search and seizure or not? How did Justice Scalia approach that question as originalist, and do you agree with his results and his reasons?
Well, as an originalist, he looked to the concept of trespass as it existed during the relevant period of the framing, and decided it pretty much on that basis. Obviously,
the trespass? The trespass was the attachment.
Attaching something to the car, because there was a warrant, but it had expired. So this was a warrantless search and or seizure. And he decided that under the laws of trespass, the attachment of a device was a trespass, and therefore the attachment, the seizure, and the obtaining of information was illegal.
He had the majority for that, but there was a sharp concurrence which took a quite different tact.
Well, let me stick with Scalia for a second,
right,
if I may. One of the problems is there are a lot of problems with his opinion. One is where does the word trespass come from? It sort of smacks of the exclusionary rule. There's nothing about trespass. Something could be a trespass and be reasonable. Something could be not a trespass and be unreasonable. So there are certain assumptions that Justice Scalia made. Another is, if you read the opinion, he is talking about land. He says I won't read it, but it's out loud. But his definition is for land. That was not appropriate. The definition of trespass for land was different than trespass for chattels. And for chattels, you needed something more, such as damage to the property or misappropriation or something like that, which is one of my arguments against originalism, which is that this is a very complicated subject that historians have trouble with, and that lawyers who are not historians, and even some who are not going to get it right. And in addition to the fact that there were like 13 laws of different states and England, and that the laws were changing in the period, you also have the problem that these concepts keep popping up, and they were not necessarily the concepts we use today, and that the whole exercise of trying to figure out what the thinking was in 1791 or whatever, it doesn't work. Another argument I have is that why should we do this? And this is a fundamental question for originalists, and that is, Justice Scalia said he was an originalist, not because the framers were originalists. In fact, it looked from my research, they weren't, and also it made no sense because they were there at the beginning, but because it sort of worked, and he liked the way it worked, and it fit in with his concept of a constitution. Gave it the stability. But there's nothing necessary about looking back to 1791 or 89, and by doing so, you are making a normative judgment that you want a society something like the one existed in 1791. And I'm not sure that that's ever been fully appreciated, and I'm not sure it's the society that I would want to be a part of.
Well, we can all agree, I think, that this was a liberal opinion in your terms, David, because the defendant got off. Mike, what do you think about the application of originalism to this particular problem? And did it work? Was it helpful?
Yeah, sure. Maybe I should just say that, and David's answer was quite wide-ranging, and there were a number of things in there that I didn't agree with, but I will stick to the more or less case. Now, one thing about being an originalist is that it's hard to make definitive conclusions about areas that you haven't looked closely at the history. I'm not a criminal procedure expert. I'm a separation of powers guy. So I really don't feel qualified to comment on whether the underlying history is right or not. But as to the methodology, I think that the methodology is quite straightforward and understandable. The question in United States versus Jones was whether this was a search, to put this GPS thing on there, and the government said it's not a search because, look, we could just follow you around and see wherever you go, and that wouldn't be considered a search as long as you're on the public street. So why does it matter whether we actually literally follow you around or whether we put this little device on you which allows us to go back and subsequently reconstruct everywhere that you went and that we could have followed you? It doesn't really count as a search. The question is, how are you going to answer that question? And one way you could answer that question, which is basically, as I understand it, the way the concurrence did, although he didn't really put it in this way, but the way you'd answer that question is, well, you know, is it reasonable to allow the government to do this kind of thing, or is it too intrusive on the person's privacy, and we'll sort of balance the interests according to our judicial intuitions and come up with the answer that we, the judges, think is the best one. And that contrasts with the way Scalia tried to do it, which was Scalia tried to understand whether this would have been considered a search at the time that the amendment was adopted. And he did that then, exactly as David said, to think about what sort of made something a search. at the time, and he concluded, and I'm bracketing the question of whether historically this is right or not, but he concluded that what made something a search, or one thing that made something a search, is that it was a trespass. That is, that if something was a trespass, then that was the kind of thing that, absent a few exceptions that weren't relevant here, you had to have a warrant for under the English law, and that was carried over into the Fourth Amendment when the Fourth Amendment was adopted. So he concluded, well, then this was a trespass because an unwanted and unpermitted touching of the property, which is what took place when they put the GPS thing on there, what was a trespass. And so you could translate the understanding of the late 18th century and the idea of what constituted a trespass and therefore triggered a warrant requirement to this case, and even using the new technology. And I think it's pretty straightforward application of an originalist methodology, and it seems to make a good bit of sense to me. Now, I agree with David, and there's a lot more we can see said about whether that's the way we want to interpret the Constitution or not, but that would probably take us another hour or so to get through that.
At least. So let's take a look at another recent criminal law case, Maryland against King. Mr. King was arrested, and a swab was taken from his mouth to identify his DNA, and from that they determined that he had been involved in another crime, I believe it was a rape, and the question was that swab from his mouth a violation of the Fourth Amendment as an unreasonable search and seizure? The majority upheld the search, and Justice Scalia filed a dissent. The defendant won, and surely that fits David's definition of liberal. David, how did Justice Scalia reach that result as a matter of originalism or textualism, and why did the majority disagree?
Well, Justice Scalia looked at it as analogized it to a general warrant, which was one of the big bugbears of the colonial era, that police or constable could get a warrant just to look for everything. And Justice Scalia said that was what was happening here, in effect, because the swab was engaged in, and incidentally, it took months to find to match up the swab with the criminal, with the rape. That was just a free-floating effort to find a theory on which you could, or evidence on which you could search for other crimes for which you had no suspects. And Scalia said, and I think correctly, that that's exactly what the law does not permit. You have no right to just say, I want a search warrant because I think this guy may have done something and I want to find out. You have to have a specific crime in mind and some probable cause or something like probable cause in order to invade someone's person in order to get evidence. And the majority said, well, it was just to identify him and all that. And they argued about that. Scalia pointed out that it didn't do any good. He was in custody 3 months before they came up with the answer, and that it was invasive, and that all sorts of arguments why you didn't need someone's DNA in order to identify him at each stage of the proceeding. I agree with the result. As I said, I'm generally liberal, and I think Justice Scalia felt that the intrusion was one of a type that could not be sustained under the conception of the individual and the rights of an individual not to be unduly searched and not the subject of a general warrant.
David, here's my question to you, and perhaps if Justice Scalia were around, I would ask him the same. The notion of a general search warrant sounds like a far-reaching intrusion into the privacy issues of everybody. This was simply putting a cotton swab in somebody's mouth, no pain, no aggravation, and a few seconds later, it's all done. Doesn't that kind of get to the problem of trying to understand the level of generality at which you're comparing what's going on today with what happened back in 1791? And is that a strength or a flaw in originalism? And Mike, jump in if you feel like
I'll speak briefly to it. I I like your point, and it's one I made, which is that many of Justice Scalia's liberal opinions were wrong, that he took liberal opinions, not necessarily this one, but he took his route to a liberal result and reached a liberal result, even though the best history was that it shouldn't have been a liberal result. And I get into this in my book, The Unexpected Scalia. Also, Justice Scalia waxed eloquently about these proud people, these proud framers would not have allowed the king to invade their person and things like that. Justice Scalia was prone to hyperbole, let's say. And it wasn't, you know, this was not a proud framer. This was a guy who had been arrested on probable cause, was in custody, and it wasn't the king's people invading the rights of a colonialist. It was the police of the same country to which this person, to which the defendant belonged. And one of my points is that Justice Scalia's occasionally, or more than occasionally, wrong history, if I could put it that way, led him to come to liberal results when he didn't have to. I mean, it was quite remarkable in the number of instances I found where I felt that he was going too liberal.
Mike, is this an originalism opinion? And maybe you could throw in the Kylo case, which is the heat-seeking device case when the police were outside somebody's home and they determined that the person was growing marijuana by using this heat-seeking device from outside. Are those originalist opinions in your view?
Well, Kylo's a real interesting one, so let me set that aside for a second and just talk about King real quickly. I think King is an originalist opinion for the reasons you've discussed. I think that the dispute between the majority and the dissent was mainly over whether some non-originalist precedent was going to carry the day, or whether that precedent should be read narrowly, which is what Scalia thought ought to happen to it. The precedent said you could do various sorts of searches for administrative purposes, like identifying the person, and the majority stuck with that, but as an exception to what I think the majority agreed was the general rule, that you couldn't have general searches of people without suspicion for investigative purposes. But I think the majority was disingenuous, whether openly or just subconsciously, in sort of accepting that, because I think Scalia made the point quite well that this was for investigative purposes. Now, I guess I don't really understand David's objection to this case, because it seems like this does follow pretty clearly from an originalist conclusion that you can't have a search, a trespass, which you know, mild as it may seem to us when it's not being done to us, you can't have somebody forcibly held and this thing stuffed in their mouth against their will, without having a warrant or some kind of warrant exception. It is a search. It is a trespass. It clearly would have been understood as a trespass in the time when the amendment was adopted. And the question doesn't call for us to speculate about whether the framers would have thought it was too much of a trespass, or whether it would have been justified for other reasons. Just that we have a rule, and we follow the rule, and that's why Scalia liked it. So I think it's a good solid originalist case, and I don't really understand the objection to it.
Well, let me quickly respond. First, I'm not saying I objected to the result. I did object to some of his characterizations. Also, there was no talk about whether somebody, let's assume someone bit somebody in the colonial era, and they opened his mouth, and they found that his teeth didn't match that one, but matched another defendant. There was no talk about this. I mean, the point is that this is sort of like wishful history. There's so little to go on. And whether it was a trespass of a person or a trespass to land, I just don't think that originalism contributed much. It's you know, the idea that you state is a valid one. Well, let's see what happened and all that. But no one ever said, well, what exactly was the law back in in 1791, and the chances may have been there was no law. And if there was a law, it was different for trespass to persons and trespass to land. There were all sorts of other considerations.
Well, again, I think it does depend on knowing the history well, and that's one reason that I am hesitant to make bold statements about the wrongness of certain history that I haven't studied real closely. And I think that that originalists should generally take that to heart. But at the same time, and of course, I would not disagree with you that there were rhetorical flourishes in Scalia's opinions. It's so much he's known for, and maybe sometimes those he got a little ahead of himself with those. But I guess I would be surprised if it were the case in the 18th century that the law allowed people to be subject to the kind of search that Mr. King was without having a warrant or a warrant exception. And again, I don't think the majority actually really disagreed with that. I think the majority had this sort of weaselly exception to that based on administrative needs.
Well, I think Scalia did a great job destroying that argument. I agree with that. And the problem is the justices and judges are not specialists, and they have all these difficult cases, and they have to be reasonably adept and knowledgeable about the history of a huge variety of things.
That's why a specialist should be employed in writing briefs to explain the technicalities. So if anybody needs an expert, I know where to find some. Let me just real quickly say something about Kylo because Alan asked about that. That I think is a really different kind of case, and I think that case is this one really is borderline as to whether that is originalist or not. In Kylo, Scalia, along with the liberal justices, said that using this thermal imaging device was a search. But the problem he had there, in very sharp contrast to King and Jones, was that there was no trespass because the police were sitting outside in the public street, and all they were doing was taking a temperature reading of the home. And
for the purposes of discovering marijuana.
For the purposes of discovering whether he was growing marijuana in it or not. Yeah. And so what Scalia said in that opinion was that although that technically there was no trespass, that if you allow the police to have access to this kind of information, which wouldn't have been available to them in the 18th century, then it changed the whole dynamic between the police and the homeowner, and it changed the whole the relative security of the home as against police snooping, as it were. But it whether that's originalist or not, I think is open to some debate. And if it is originalist, it's a form of originalism applied to new technology that gets pretty far beyond things that you can derive from 18th century practices. So I really think Kylo is a different category, but it's a really interesting case.
All right, I want to shift now. To a case which I had something to do with as a writer of one of the briefs on behalf of the District of Columbia. This is the District of Columbia versus Heller, one of, if not the most significant opinion of Justice Scalia in dealing with the Second Amendment right to bear arms. And he concluded that the right to bear arms included the right to self-defense and that the District of Columbia could not require, essentially forbid, individuals from having handguns in their home. David, how did he go about reaching his broad conclusion regarding the right of self-defense? And do you think that's a good example of his originalism at work?
Well, the answer to the second part of the question is no. I think he did a sort of a word analysis. What did the word bear mean? What did the word arms mean? What was the role of the preamble, which referred to the militia? And to me, it was a very formalistic and unsatisfactory opinion.
But didn't he look at a lot of what was said and done back in the framing era and before and indeed part of it was afterwards as well?
Yeah, first of all, the part that was after is something that I don't understand his doing, because he always said that post enactment history or cases are irrelevant. You know, he had, you know, I'm not saying he had nothing. What I am saying is that, you know, he had some things to rely on, but the things that majority had, I think, were much stronger. I think he, as
well, he was in the majority. You said
I'm
the
sorry,
majority.
Yeah,
had...
You're absolutely right. It's wishful thinking, but that's another story. He took a rather mechanical view, and in my opinion, did not do the issue justice. For example, the role of a preamble is something that has been researched and written about, and it was much more significant than Justice Scalia acknowledged. Chief Justice John Jay, as I quote in my book and was quoted in the briefs, said that preambles are important. If you look at the discussion in the constitutional conventions and elsewhere, 95% of the references were to militia. If you look at state constitutions, only Virginia had anything resembling a gun protection. So I could go on and on, but basically it's really a question of evidence and also a question of whether originalism should be applied, whether we should decide whether guns should be extensively distributed and allowed based on a country that was totally different.
Let me ask you this. Justice Stevens dissented on the main point. Justice Breyer had another dissent, which I'll talk about in a second. But did Justice Stevens disagree with Justice Scalia's originalism approach, regardless of how you think they handled it? Didn't Justice Stevens take the originalism approach to try to answer this question?
Oh, yes, of course, because he had to answer the majority, and because the justices on the majority did it on originalism grounds. So Justice Stevens wrote an originalism dissent, and Justice Breyer wrote a non-originalist dissent. And
Did they look at the same evidence, Scalia and Stevens, come to different conclusions?
They had the same evidence because they had all these briefs, some by very prominent historians, but they interpreted it differently.
Mike, how does this case, just from a perspective of one of the things that I understood Justice Scalia favored originalism was because it didn't require a justice to be subjective, didn't permit a justice to be subjective, and that this method would produce greater certainty, and that's of value in itself. Does the contrasting opinions in Heller suggest anything about originalism to you, or is it just to me that it suggests something?
Well, I'll speak briefly first, and I'm sure Mike has plenty to say because he's knowledgeable on this, and that is that if you have all sorts of what I call, and I think somebody else called, dueling originalist opinions, the certainty is gone. I mean, you have opinion after opinion that the originalist opinions on both sides, and it just changes the focus of the debate from one thing to another without the advantage, in my opinion, of certainty. So,
two points on that. I think, first of all, it's important to understand when we're talking about certainty that value for choosing originalism that we're talking about relative certainty here. And originalist is going to tell you that originalism will give you certain answers in every case. Or even in a lot of cases. The cases are hard. The cases that go to the Supreme Court are the hardest cases. You're going to get tough cases under any interpretive methodology that you pick. The question is whether originalism does a better job. And I think to connect up with something David said that's exactly right in terms of what Justice Scalia was thinking, does it do a better job of creating a non-subjective, that is, something where the judges are not just arguing about what's the best policy, but something they're arguing about, something that is in the real world. It may be difficult to ascertain, but it is something real. That is, you know, what the best meaning of this language at the time it was enacted was. And that's it's better to argue about that, Scalia said, than it is to turn the judges loose to try to decide subjectively what's the best policy. Now, you might disagree with that point, but that's Scalia's claim.
Let me say one thing. What originalism in its pure form does, something like Clarence Thomas tends to do, is discard precedent. And precedent is there. And the precedent leans a certain way in many cases, and I think
Scalia was willing to follow precedent a lot of the time, but precedent doesn't decide cases either, not with any sort of certainty, particularly when we don't have a theory of precedent that says when you follow it and when you don't. But if I could just go back to Stevens opinion, sort of what Heller means for the certainty of originalism, I think that sort of the uncertainty that you might conclude arises from Heller is overstated. Because I think what you really see with one important thing that you see between Stevens and Scalia and Heller is that they're actually using to some extent a different originalist methodology. In that what Stevens is especially interested in is sort of trying to get inside the mind of the framers. It goes back to a point that we made earlier on this call about sort of trying to guess what the subjective intent of the framers were, what the framers were really driving at, or what was the main motivation they had for doing the things that they were doing, writing the things that they wrote. And a lot of what you see in Stevens' opinion is trying to get at that. This is what the framers really feared, and therefore that's what we should now read the provision to protect against. Scalia, in contrast, was much more focused on figuring out, as we talked about earlier, what the original meaning of the actual things that was written would be to the reasonable observer at the time. Now, you could dispute whether he got it right or not, but that was his focus. And I think the disagreement, to some extent, was not about what the sources meant or sources said, but rather it was about what should be most strongly weighted in reaching the conclusion. I think Scalia would say, if you use my methodology, which I think is the right originalist methodology, not Stevens's methodology, which is the wrong one, then you would be much more confident that the conclusion that I, Scalia, reached was correct. And just real quick, too, I think there's a lot of textualism in this opinion, but I think, as you mentioned, that there's a lot of context, too. And he looks at not just the post-enactment, which I think is perfectly appropriate for a originalist to see sort of how a provision was read shortly after it was adopted, but also he looks very much at the pre-enactment situation. That is, what was the law of gun regulation in England? Because the Second Amendment seems to refer to a pre-existing right of gun ownership, and Scalia looks at what that was, and that's how he comes to the conclusion that it's really about self-defense, because the Second Amendment doesn't, in it, so many words, say anything about self-defense. But he looks back at the English law and says, look, that this was a lot about self-defense, and that's what carried over into our law. And that's a contextualist reading, which is perfectly appropriate under originalism. And I think sometimes we think of Scalia so much as a textualist that we lose track of the other things he used to get at the original meaning.
Well, let me say one quick statement. Sure. I would not hold up Stevens as any expert. My whole point is that justices and judges are not equipped to do it. If you looked at some of the briefs and books on the subject, you'd come to a very different conclusion. I could go on, but
we're going to turn to the audience for questions. So if you have a question, indicate that you're interested in asking one, and Dean Reuter will put you on. But the second part of the Heller opinion, after going through and declaring that the right applied to self-defense, went and said, well, of course, we don't mean all guns and all laws are okay. Are forbidden, excuse me, and that the justice then went through and described that felons, of course, could be taken care of, were this, and you couldn't have them in certain times and places. Was that an originalist portion of his opinion, David and Michael? And what we're talking about, which laws were these that we're talking about today? Were they in existence back in 1791? And were the places that they were in existence comparable to what we have now?
Let me say this. They had regulations back then. It was not, there were regulations in the states. The exceptions, I think Justice Scalia, I never got to get an answer from him. I think that was to pick up a fifth vote, perhaps. But
was that an originalist portion of his opinion,
no,
David?
No.
Michael?
The point is, then you get to the problem, what do you mean, what when you talk about bearing arms in 1791, what did you mean? I asked Leah once, I said, do you mean you had to carry it? And he says, interesting point. I mean, the point is, bear arms was a term of art that referred to military use. And that's overwhelmingly the case. And Justice Scalia instead went to dictionary and looked up bear. He looked up arms and said, aha, that was a miserable methodology. And I told him so.
Yeah,
right.
Well, just you got keep in there as well as bear, just
yeah,
to be clear
right.
on that. And and so I think it's a little more complicated there than you're saying. But just,
I agree.
Okay.
If I could just
answer the question, though, real quickly about the exceptions, because Scalia was criticized for those. But my answer is yes, that's an originalist part of the opinion. What it's doing is it's not deciding those questions because they weren't before the court. But what it's leaving open, and perfectly appropriately leaving open under an originalist methodology, is to say, look, there may be some exceptions to this. These rights aren't categorical because they came out of pre-existing rights in English law, and those pre-existing rights have exceptions. So it's very similar to free speech under the First Amendment, because free speech is notwithstanding the apparently absolute language that is used, it's not considered to be absolute. Scalia didn't consider it to be absolute. Nobody thinks it's absolute. And similarly, nobody thinks that the Second Amendment is absolute, because there were pre-existing exceptions that were recognized under the law and incorporated into it. And all Scalia was saying in that passage you quote is, hey, there are some pre-existing exceptions. We don't have to decide what they are right now because it's not in front of the court. But just to be clear, that we're not excluding them, and that's all that paragraph is saying. And I'm sure that paragraph,
his
idea was fleshing it out, would have been by looking at what the historical understanding was.
Dean Reuter, do we have some questions from the audience?
I need to open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that'll say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Dean Morrison, at this point, we don't have a question. I'll let you know if we get a question. Oh, we do have one question. So let me go to our first caller and remind the caller to try and be as succinct as possible since we have under 10 minutes left.
In Employment Division versus Smith, did Scalia consider at all setting aside the precedent of Reynolds versus United States and just trying to restructure the entire freedom of free exercise of religion debate? Do you all know?
This is David Dorsch. I'll start the discussion. Smith was quite a revolutionary decision, which eliminated, in my mind, the fundamental purpose of the religion clauses, which was to give minority, or my fundamental purpose, which was to give minorities the right to practice their religion. So what Scalia, in effect, did was he said, oh, only if your right is protected by legislation, which, of course, is a majority accomplishment, will we respect it. It's respected so that laws of general applicability must be followed by religions. And, of course, Catholics, Jews, Protestants, and others of that, large religions won't be affected, but minority religions. And that was contrary, in my view, to the whole theory of the First Amendment religion clauses.
This is Mike Ramsey. I think that Employment Division is subject to some substantial criticism on an originalist methodology perspective. Again, I tend to leave aside the history of things that I don't know the history of. Because that opinion really doesn't go back. If you go look at the opinion, it really doesn't go back into the history of what the free exercise clause, where the free exercise came from, or what it was, what it would have meant at the time. It was it spent a lot of time talking about precedent, even though the precedent was arguably quite sharply the other direction, but it talked about distinguishing the precedent, and it rested to a significant extent on the proposition that the plaintiffs had not shown, that is, they had not carried a burden of proof that the law was unconstitutional, but did not assemble, I would say, did not assemble systematically an originalist account of the free exercise clause in the May that might have been hoped. So from my perspective, irrespective of the outcome and the history, I think it is a disappointing opinion.
Let me make one point, and that is Justice Scalia was not a consistent originalist. For example, his free speech any law that tended to favor viewpoint of favor a particular viewpoint was unconstitutional really had nothing to do with the original understanding. And in fact, the original understanding of free speech was that just about anything could be punished as long as the person was given a right to say it first. So the Justice Scalia's originalism is spotty, I would say.
Dean, do we have any other questions coming up?
We don't have any questions pending, so go right.
Just on the last point, two things. One, sure, Scalia's originalism was spotty in the sense that he believed in precedent. Now, how much he believed in precedent, you could debate, because he was certainly willing to overrule quite a few things. But he believed that that you had to work within the existing construct of modern law, as well as looking to originalism. So in areas like free speech and the First Amendment, where there was a lot of non-originalist thinking out there, he worked a lot under the precedent that had been established. And so it's sometimes difficult to untangle what he was deriving from precedent and what he was deriving for original meaning. I think, though, just on to continue the point on the First Amendment, though, I think that he had a very textualist view of the First Amendment, actually, of the free speech provision, which was that that it was understood as a pretty categorical rule, subject to the exceptions that were recognized at the time. And then his view of the exceptions that were recognized at the time, that is the time of adoption, were pretty narrow. And then you can say that history's wrong, and maybe it is, although I got to say that David's a lot more confident of a wide range of history than I am. But methodologically, I don't think that his free speech cases are as far out of line as sometimes suggested, far out of line of originalism as sometimes suggested.
Well, David, the only point I would make is that under Blackstone and all and the authorities that existed around 1790, you could punish speech, but you could not prevent it, and the same with the press. So I think you're right. He's consistent in many respects, and I think it's a brilliant analysis, but it's not originalism.
I think it is originalism. It's just you don't agree with it as a historical matter. But I think the question is whether the First Amendment was designed to pick up that Blackstonian view, or whether the colonists had come up with their own view of free speech, and that was the reference point of the First Amendment. I think that's the debate, and I agree that Scalia, who looked to English law in a lot of areas, as we've been discussing on this call, but didn't look to English law in First Amendment, probably owed more explanation for that approach than he gave. But I don't think it's non-originalist. I think you just don't agree with the history, and that's fair enough. But I'm not a First Amendment guy either, so I only go so far with that.
All right. I've got just time for one more question, I think. David, you describe – I agree with you generally on your characterization of the opinions as either liberal or conservative within the terms that you have defined it. You cite Citizens United as an opinion in which the justice was equivocal between liberal and conservatism. But that's the case involving corporate spending on political campaigns. The liberals unanimously oppose that opinion, if you need to look at number two on your list on page two, and yet you treat that as equivocal. How did you get that into that category?
Well, the reason is in that category is that, first of all, the ACLU took the same position as Scalia, basically.
Well, it did originally, it had moved a little bit.
That's what counts. So therefore, and also the originalist asserted a first Bill of Rights arguments I'm sure Bill of Rights arguments for their position, namely free speech. And that's why I put it ambivalently. I think I come out totally differently from Justice Scalia, however, because I think the whole tenor of the colonial and early and revolutionary periods and post-revolutionary periods was one for equality of opportunity to speak. The anonymous speech was there not because the people were afraid, but because the anti-federalists in particular did not want the federalist superstars to get credit for their pedigree rather than the force of their argument. I make a lengthy argument in my book as to why, in a sense, this was factionalism and a few other problems with Citizens United, including that corporations were not respected in the 1780s. It's a complicated subject, and I can only refer to my book, The Unexpected Scalia.
I have a real quick comment on Citizens United, which I think that was another great illustration of the difference between Scalia and Stevens in their originalism, that both wrote concurring or dissenting opinions to add some originalism to it. Stevens was all about trying to get inside the mind of the framers. He said that framers didn't like corporations, so they probably wouldn't wanted corporations to have these kind of free speech rights. And Scalia said, well, look, that may well be, but the First Amendment doesn't say anything about corporations, and the way that free speech law was applied at the time didn't distinguish between.
So it's an unenumerated right of a corporation.
There isn't any exception for corporations to the general rule that you can't restrict speech. And again, I think Scalia takes a pretty textualist view of the thing. A very abbreviated one. I wish he'd said more. And Stevens takes an intent-driven one, and just it's a different way of thinking about what the process is doing.
The role of corporations, in my view, is more complicated. They can't vote. They shouldn't have religious rights because they are not. They don't have consciences and souls. But it's. I agree. It's a complicated area.
We've been discussing The Unexpected Scalia, and I think we have all agreed that the book is extremely thought-provoking, and it has a message that many of us, particularly those who identify with the liberal side of the political spectrum, would find surprising. We would recognize that there were cases like the flag-burning case where Justice Scalia came down on the liberal side, but until I read David's book, I had not realized the extent to which and the vast areas over which Justice Scalia's willingness to take his methodologies of originalism and textualism to what he considered to be their logical conclusions, whether rightly or wrongly, that he actually did it and carried it out. He liked to say that he didn't care about the consequences of his decisions. He just wanted to know what the words meant. And while that's kind of hard to accept for myself and probably for most other people, he certainly did carry that out in a great many areas. And so speaking for myself, I encourage everybody to read David's very fine and thought-provoking book on the opinions of extraordinarily talented and interesting justice with whom some of us agreed from time to time and disagreed from time to time. Dean, do we have anything further on the call today?
No, I will wrap things up. Thank you very much. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank our guests, Professor Michael Ramsey, author David Dorson, the book, again, The Unexpected Scalia. If you got an announcement to this call, you've got a link to the book page on Amazon. And, of course, our moderator, Dean Alan Morrison. And finally, I want to thank the audience. Thank you for dialing in. A reminder to our audience to check the website and check your emails for our next scheduled Teleforum conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.